Thank God it's Free Range. You are listening to Free Range Radio Friday with your host, Michael Elves. Pour yourself a beverage and turn up the volume, because here on 101.5 UMFM, the weekend starts now.
Thank you. 101.5 UMFM. This is, thank God, it's Free Range, the Friday edition of Free Range Radio. And starting things off for us tonight, Summer Candy from Ona, West Virginia band, just about to release a new record, and that is the lead-off track. And boy, is it just a kind of drug dealer-esque, psych pop kind of shimmery tune. Felt like a good thing to start off with tonight. We've got, of course, Ticket Momsters Go to the Gig recommendations coming up, one of which is one of my guests coming up a little later. And also, speaking of guests, earlier this week, novelist Guy Gabriel Kay stopped by to discuss his most recent novel, A Brightness Long Ago. And so we'll have that interview coming up around 7 o'clock. But before we do that, VV Lightbody, who was responsible for one of my favorite records of last year. The Chicago artist has a new single out, debuted this week, and here it is right now here on 101.5 UMFM.
Yeah. Hey, it's Ticket Momster. Let's get right into it. Tomorrow, Saturday, May 18th, Leaf Rapids are at McNally Robinson for an in-store performance and album signing. And that event is free. Shares at Bell MTS Place on Tuesday, tickets at ticketmaster.ca. And on the 22nd is the St. James Infirmary Blues at Neil Bardell Funeral Center. Yeah, I know. But they're promising an exciting concert of New Orleans-inspired big band music with special guests, maybe Todd Martin. And this is a fundraiser in support of the Winnipeg Jazz Orchestra Recording Fund. So there you go. Tickets at winnipegjazzorchestra.com. I don't usually recommend documentaries, but the Jewish Film Festival starts next week, and they're showing It Must Be Schwing, the story about Blue Note Records, and this is on Thursday, May 23rd. Tickets at radiojcc.com. I know very little about Blue Note Records, but I'd love to know more, so I'm very interested in this. Let me read to you a bit about it. As Jewish teenagers in Berlin, Alfred Lion and Francis Wolff cemented a friendship with a mutual love for contemporary American music, especially jazz. Both fled Germany after Hitler's rise to power. The two friends found each other again in New York, where the Lion and the Wolff went on and found the legendary Blue Note record label. It's an intimate look at a key time in New York history with a great soundtrack and stunning innovative visuals, with appearances by Herbie Hancock, Sonny Rollins, and Quincy Jones, and many other jazz greats. Oh, that sounds so good. Speaking of jazz greats, I love drummer Art Blakey, and Blue Note Records released an album by the Art Blakey Quintet called A Night at Birdland, Volumes 1 and 2. So let's listen to a tune off that album called Quicksilver, and I'll come back with one more show recommendation for next week. Art Blakey Quintet with Quicksilver off their A Night at Birdland album released by Blue Note Records. The Rady JCC is showing a documentary about Blue Note Records this Thursday, May 23rd. Tickets at radyjcc.com. Okay, let's switch gears. So if you read my Ticket Momster blog on Facebook, you know I'm a big fan of J.D. Edwards' band. I first saw them at Festival de Voyageur and I just totally fell in love with their music. Well, J.D. is playing with his other band, The Small Glories, at the West End Cultural Center this Friday, May 24th. Tickets at eventbrite.ca. I've never seen or heard The Small Glories, but I'm very interested in anything else J.D. Edwards is involved in. I'm not going to play a Small Glories song right now because I don't want to hear any of their music before I see them live. So I'm going to play my current obsession from the J.D. Edwards band. I can't stop playing this one, so I guess it's just part of me now. This is called I Can Swim. If you want to see more show recommendations, check out my Facebook page at Ticket Momster. I've got a post pinned to the top of the page and I'm updating it all the time. Lots of stuff going on in Winnipeg. Have a great week. Good night.
Talking to my body about sailing on a clear blue sea. And it's hard to accept that I'm here right now, out in the fog, approaching the rocks. But I can swim, I can hear you say. Now I'm afraid we'll jump in before we begin to ride the ship.
was afraid of becoming a man. He talked lightly of money, growing a beard. He was all that his papa could stand. And he got to the age where he filled up with rage, like an hourglass fills up the sand. And even though he was so low, he knew how to live for the day. Of a man or a mouse, he didn't talk till I played Townes Van Zandt. And at that point in time, he would say down the line, we became friends and never were bad. But even though what you know is what you know, what is true that remains. Hey, even then, it's a countdown for when you might meet up again.
Noted, acclaimed author, translated into many different languages, but here to talk about his most recent book in English, Guy Gabriel Kay. Welcome.
It's nice to be back.
I am excited to start at the end of this book, because in the acknowledgments, you kind of reveal the path that led you to this book. And you talk about sometimes it's a very clear linear line, and sometimes it's a circuitous route. And A Brightness Long Ago took a very circuitous route from the sounds of it. And so I'm very interested in process and like the genesis of creation. And so I'd like to talk to you about, you know, is this an unusual path for you? Or like, does it kind of, book to book, does it just dramatically differ?
It's book to book, Michael. I don't have a template. I don't have a formula for how books arrive for me. So I couldn't call it unusual because there is no usual
right.
in that sense. This one emerged, and this has happened before, from several different strands of things that engaged me. One was, on the most basic level, I wasn't ready to leave the Renaissance. That I'd written a book, Children of Earth and Sky, my last book, is inspired by elements of the late 15th century. And this one is too, although earlier, middle 15th century. The years when we're talking about the emergence of the Medici, Michelangelo, Raphael, Piero della Francesca, those glamorous figures of politics and art
right.
fascinated me. But equally, I wanted to do a book that picks up on the other side of that coin, which is to say, when we think Renaissance, we think great art and powerful political figures. We need to be aware of, need to is the wrong word, I'd like people to be aware of, the violence, the danger, the randomness of life in those years and those times, whether or not your children survived the winter might depend upon things way outside your control.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to do a book that picked up on both the glittering aspect of the time and on the darker aspect. It showed that they're both there.
Right.
That's one element, anyhow.
Now, was this a circumstance where you had some of this research from Children of Earth and Sky, like that you had explored this when you were
some
looking at that
over.
Book, and it was like, I can pull from that?
Some came over. Several books were new to me. I do a lot nowadays. I've often said the internet for me is most useful, not so much for what's on it, but for who's on it, so that I end up being able to read a book by a scholar on a theme or in a period and find them.
Mm.
And one good thing about getting older, there aren't that many, but one good thing about getting older is that there's a better chance someone will have heard of me.
Mm.
So if I show up out of nowhere in the inbox of some academic at Columbia or Cambridge, there's a fighting chance. First of all, they're usually courteous anyhow, even if they've never heard of you.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a fighting chance that they're going to know who I am and what I'm doing and why I'm writing and what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So I've ended up actually making some good friends this way. And if it doesn't end up in that degree of connection, it certainly has given me a lot of material. They'll steer me to articles by other people. And so the research is always going to incorporate new elements in the new book. This book has at its centerpiece, I don't think this counts as a spoiler, it has a horse race.
Mm-hmm.
It has a pretty dramatic horse race in which several plot elements come together in and around the race. And that race is based on the Palio, which is an actual horse race that began in Siena in medieval times and has continued towards the present day. There have been protests and it's been blocked more recently for good reasons, I would say, from the 21st century point of view, because of concern for the health of the horses.
Mm-hmm.
But for 600-700 years, this race through the central square of the Tuscan city of Siena was the big moment of the year. And I did a lot of reading and a lot of research into the nature and parameters of the race for this book.
Right. Did you become aware of the Palio when you were doing research on
the
Renaissance era?
I became aware of the Palio because we lived there when I was writing Tagama. We lived in a village between Siena and Florence, and in one of those wonderful moments in your life, we used to go into Siena or Florence all the time, and we would drive into Siena and find a parking spot near the central square. It wasn't that difficult in fall, and walk to whatever we wanted to see, the bar, or cafe, or restaurant. And one day, we're going into Siena on a Sunday, we said, let's go into the town. And there was a traffic jam, and it was mobbed. We ended up having to park well outside the walls, illegally, but that's Italian, and hike into the city. And we discovered, as we're going in with crowds of people, we discovered that this was the day where the district of the city whose horse had won the Palio earlier in the year was leading the parade through the city to celebrate their triumph.
Mm.
And so people all through the city are in Renaissance costume, and the winning district is lord of the manor in front of all the others that they parade through.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started doing some question asking. It wasn't research at that point. I was just asking people, what's the story? That's when I first learned about the Palio.
So when you're doing question asking instead of research, it's simply just curiosity and you know, you're squirreling this away with not necessarily a context in which to place it?
Absolutely true. I'll give you another example of this that's very much a part of the underpinning of A Brightness Long Ago. This book is framed partly through the first-person narration, the memories of a man of about 47 or 8 years of age, looking back 25 years or so on a year or two of his life when he was a young man that were tremendously dramatic for him and for that part of the world. He met some extraordinary people. And I remembered, I remembered that my brother, who is a psychiatrist who did his medical degree here in Winnipeg, same way I did my undergrad here, my brother had told me about 15 years before that there are actually neurological, biological reasons why we remember the years from about 15 to 25 or 6 so vividly. It has to do with brain chemistry and development. There are reasons why. Mm-hmm. You know the song that ended your high school graduation dance, or why you skipped the damn dance. You know that vividly and intensely. And when I was framing and shaping this book, which is about memory, that's one of the reasons I wanted to have that protagonist looking back, it was such a pleasure to remember myself that factoid that he'd given me. I asked him to back myself up. I asked him to do the hard work and find me a couple of medical journal pieces that supported it.
Research.
And he did.
Now, you said, you know, this is partially about memory, and that so obviously the way in which it's told is a memory. Do you go in with kind of like a thought about like what you want to explore? Because there's issues of faith, chance, storytelling. Do you have kind of like word balloon, large words that you're like, I want to weave
That's
these in?
That's a great phrase. No, I don't have it in terms of word balloons. I do have certain motifs that seem to me worth exploring as a novelist. I don't outline the books, so I'm learning the story as I go to a significant degree. But I do have these motifs or themes that seem to me worth teasing out, and sometimes I get surprised by them. There will be things I go into a book thinking, this is what that book's going to be about, and en route, other things come in to join them or sometimes supersede them, take over as being central to the story. So in this one, there's no question that I wanted to do a book about how our lives today, you and I here in the studio and people in 15th century near Italy, our lives are a mixture of choices we make, random accident that comes in and affects us, and a feeling that fortune, luck, chance have this impact on us that people don't like. We don't like the destabilizing feeling sometimes of not being in control.
Yeah, you talk about fortune's wheel and the, you know, where it lands when it spins for a person, but the central character, Danio, I mean, he's got several different names, talks about you can choose to spin that wheel, though. And so for him, there's like an inflection point at which he makes a choice, and that essentially pushes him down the path that he ends up on. In that instance, you know, he's presented with that choice. So was it kind of like creating a situation in which someone was able to explore that element of life and that I don't want to say schism between like fated things and you know, a purposeful life, but that there's a gray area.
There's a tension. I like to think of it in terms of a tension we all experience. Look, if you walk into a bar and you decide to go to the far end of the bar and you meet someone at that far end of the bar and you end up marrying them or you end up living with them for half a dozen years And if you had walked to the near end of the bar, you'd never have met that person.
Mm-hmm.
You have a life. You might have love and drama and excitement and parenthood, all of the various possible things that might come into your life. But you wouldn't have it with that person. You wouldn't have that set of experiences. That's the random component of all of our existence. At the same time, we can make a choice. We can decide that if we're an American right now, that we will just live with the new anti-abortion laws passed and the assault on Roe v. Wade that's beginning, or they can decide, I'm going to push back. I'm going to engage with this because I think it's wrong. And that is a personal choice. Things will flow from that that you don't have complete control over. This is the sort of thing that it's always interested me, but in this particular book, it's kind of foregrounded. Obviously, what we're talking about when we're talking about the themes and elements. Michael, I hate books as a reader that bang you on the head, like with a mallet, with what the writer wants you to think and feel.
Mm.
I'm much happier stabbing you in the ribs with a stiletto you didn't know I had. I get you either way, but I don't want to make the themes and motifs the dominant, overwhelming element of a book. What I really want is for you to be reading a story, an adventure, a drama, a tense narrative about characters you've come to care about, and I want to keep you bloody awake till 3 a.m. I don't want you to go to sleep the night you're reading my book. At the same time, and this is where the stiletto comes in, I want you 6 months or 6 years later to experience something or read something in the newspaper or see something on the street, and something comes into your head and say, that reminds me of something I read in that book by Kay,
mm-hmm.
5, 6 years ago. That's the stiletto. That's the thing that stuck in you without you even realizing it necessarily, that you have been affected and altered in how you look at the world by that book.
Your authorial voice is like an insistent whisper then, rather than a shout at the at the reader. I mentioned there's sort of a central character from which you tell the bulk of the story, but there are a couple of other people whose head spaces you get into, particularly when you were talking earlier about the Renaissance had these powerful figures, but what did it do to the people without power? And Helena, the healer character,
mm-hmm.
I would say is on the like powerless side of the equation, but is very aware of what power she does have within mm-hmm. that powerless structure and what choices she can make, and then also what kind of currents of fate guide her as well. I'm curious about kind of creating an echoing voice to Danio's, or like, you know, like a parallel path as far as it comes to notions of fate and
well, the thing that has always one of the things that has always engaged me has been a desire to create female characters that have as much intensity and resonance for the reader as male characters. This isn't for me, it is for other writers, I know, but it's not for me a political statement as such. It's a novelist's statement. It's that a book has more chance to signify for a reader, to matter, to feel compelling, if more characters are engaging and fully realized.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that I'm going to try to do that with the female as well as the male characters. At the same time, when you're writing about the past, whether people are high-ranking or low-ranking, or utterly powerless, as you may suggest, it's foolish to ignore the fact that most cultures and periods of history have been seriously problematic in terms of the agency and scope and ambit for women within those cultures. That's just a reality.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I'm trying to do is show how women could push back against those constraints and restraints in their lives while not being utterly false to the historical reality. I don't want to pretend it wasn't so. I want to acknowledge that it was so and show a couple of different kinds of ways that women in this book, there's two of them. There's one who's a well-born woman and there's one who becomes a healer from a family of no significance at all. And each in their own way is pushing back against the expectations of what her life is supposed to be in the, by the laws or the rules of the society she's in. And in each case, my research showed me templates, figures from the past, from the 15th century, who could serve to reassure me that I'm not just winging this, I'm not just breaking all the rules. There were people who did similar things. And as an artist, I take a lot of strength from the research that lets me say I'm grounded.
In the acknowledgments, you actually say history is the underpinning of an invention
exactly
for an
right.
author.
Exactly right. The research, the historical reality are the, you know how when you write a sonnet, you're limiting yourself to 14 lines in a rhyme scheme for the sonnet or whatever. When I'm writing my historical fantasies, when I'm doing history with that quarter turn to the fantastic, I'm going to accept to as great a degree as I can the historical reality of the time that I'm writing about. I'm not going to research it and then trash it. I'm going to research it and find ways to work with it. And I think that makes for a more powerful novel, if I do it right, for the reader, than a novel set in the past that works with 21st century characters, which happens a lot, by the way. And as a matter of fact, Michael, commercially speaking, that's pretty much the most successful way to write about history today, is you superimpose our values and our kinds of personality on people in the 8th, 12th, 15th, 17th century. You throw us back in time, and the way the characters in the book react is the way they would react if they were in the bar down the street. I'll try not to do that.
So how do you as a contemporary person put yourself in the mind space to not do that?
That's a great question. Henry James, the great Henry James, the novelist, once said that historical fiction is impossible for pretty much exactly the reason you're querying. James said that we cannot shed our contemporary sensibility. The further back we go, the more alien the people of the past are. And I've always said, I get it, I understand him, and I disagree. I've always framed it as, that's our job. Our job is to the greatest degree we as an artist can do, can manage. We have to try to honor the different way people in the past saw the world. I'll make another point about this. In this book and almost everything I've written, two things equally fascinate me. One of them is what I just said, what James was noting, how very strange the past is. Somebody once said the past is a strange country, they do things differently there. So how very strange the past is, the things people believed, the degree, for example, that faith and religion dominated the worldview of Europe, but not just Europe, the fears and apprehensions that operated that we don't actually understand. That's one side of it, that strangeness. But any reading you do, any time you spend looking into historical memoirs, biographies by people in the 15th century, of people in the 15th century, you start finding a deeply moving familiarity. People wanted their children to be safe. They might want them to have a better life than they had. They wanted to leave a legacy, if it's just a farm that's still flourishing after they're gone. They wanted love, they wanted friendship, they wanted financial security. All of these things have to be profoundly familiar and recognizable to someone today. And so what I'm getting at is that I love to try to present both the strangeness and the familiarity in a book.
It sounds like Maslow's hierarchy of needs would apply even as far back as you can go in terms of looking at someone's life on that scope. You mentioned, the faith and belief in religion underpinning a lot of what people did. You do kind of I don't want to say hedge against that, but Daniel seems to kind of be agnostic, I suppose. And he does talk about, the uncertainty of going through a life without a fixed North Star of faith, right? That it's a riskier life to live that way in unbelief.
There's a balancing act. I've written characters who are deeply devout in whatever faith they lived in, and I've written characters who were, as you say, more agnostic about how deeply committed they were to the prevailing religious norms of their day. And I put them in conflict with each other,
mm-hmm.
because that's what will happen. So in this case, my protagonist is not a man, one of the protagonists, there are several in the book, but Daniel Guadagno is not a man deeply immersed in formal religion. But at the same time, you'll remember that one particularly colossal, dramatic event happens late in the book. He spends the night with others all night on his knees in the chapel praying.
Mm-hmm.
That's not uncommon, that reversion to or access to faith and belief will hit people in crisis, that we will skate through our lives, to use a Winnipeg phrasing, that we'll skate through our lives as long as they're moving normally, but that in moments of crisis, then we might look for some access to intervention. It's very common in the Renaissance. One of the motifs of Renaissance real history was for men, almost invariably men, to make colossal fortunes in Florence, in Venice, in Milan, in Rome, and do so with money lending that was forbidden by the church, do so with various sharp dealing as businessmen, because this is the emergence of the age of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And late in life, it is almost, you can almost predict it. Late in life, where they feel their mortal end is coming, they panic. They say, I've broken all of the laws of the church and God, and they endow a monastery or a convent with a colossal fortune, or they have an artist paint frescoes for, this is the Scrivani Chapel in Padua, was donated by a guilt-stricken family for their having gotten so wealthy. They gave back a big part of it to the church at the end of their life. That sudden rediscovery of faith is a norm at moments of crisis or at a perception that life might be coming to an end soon and eternity awaits me and I don't want to spend it in hell.
Right. Now, you mentioned Guadagno, it's his memory, it's his telling of the book, but that there are other characters whose heads get into. Do you, is there a limit to the number of, interior voices that work within a story like this? Were there people whose heads you didn't get into? Or, how do you decide whose stories get told from their perspective?
Of course there's a limit, and you have to be really aware of it when you're shaping a narrative, because you don't want to confuse the reader. You don't want to overwhelm them with the number of different voices. And we've all read books that were by good writers where we felt there are too many people crowding onto the stage. What I did with this one was, for the first time, Michael, it's the first time I've ever written a novel where part of the story is told in the first person singular. Mm. Daniel was saying, I remember this. I did this. That's his voice. But as you say, there are several other characters who are given the narrative at different times. And so Adria Ripoli, a young woman who is in fact an assassin when we first meet her, It's on page 4, so I'm not spoiling anything. She walked into the room. She saw this. She's not looking back. She's experiencing things in the moment she's doing them.
Right.
Yellen and the Seer, the young woman who is a healer, is another one who is seeing things in the moment that they are happening. One of the advantages I discovered, and this wasn't planned, I discovered this, was that by telling part of the story in the first person singular with Danyo, the part I knew I was doing was that I could work with memory.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking back. It's 25 years later. He's remembering this time. I knew that. But what I didn't realize was that I was making it easier for the reader to situate herself in the book. Because when it's first person singular, when it's I, when I shift there, you know where you are.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not juggling as many other third person voices, because one of them carrying a large chunk of the book, not all of it, but carrying a large chunk, is that first person. You know who's talking.
Right. Well, the book is A Brightness Long Ago, Guy. Thanks very much for coming in and talking about the book.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed the conversation.
Not really a supergroup, the individual members of Marin are all accomplished artists in their own right and veteran performers. Their combined efforts have resulted in a brand new EP, Coral Island, that gets its release at the Goodwill Social Club on Friday, May 24th, at a special show featuring support from Veneer and Baseball Hero. Tickets are only $10 and are available at the door, so get there when they open at 9 and get a good vantage point to watch Marin perform music from the Coral Island EP at the special release show presented by Real Love Winnipeg and proudly supported by 101.5 UMFM.
All right, 101.5 UMFM. This is Thank God It's Free Range, the Friday edition of Free Range Radio. You just heard an interview I did earlier this week with Guy Gavriel Kay. His new book, A Brightness Long Ago, is out and available. You can get it at McNally Robinson, where he appeared this past Wednesday. Next Friday night is Cinnabon in the Red. The new record from the Small Glories gets its Winnipeg release at the West End Cultural Center. But here to perform live in studio, Kara Luft, J.D. Edwards, The Small Glories.
This song is called Oh My Love.
Darling, can you hear me? I'm calling your name on the mountainside. Your voice is soft and soothing. Haven't felt this way in a long, long time. Oh, my love, my dearest love. Oh, my body's aching. Oh, my soul is wide open. And my heart is breaking. Oceans and the great divide, longing
This song is called Secondhand.
Begs and don't do it justice. You can see the things I see. Don't need to hear about a second hand. You'd be there if you did to come along with me. Drove down the road this morning. The sun was at my back. Curved down to the cold, clear water. Past a run-down fishing shack. Across the bay, the autumn leaves. I turned the hills to flame. A small bird just fluttered by, singing out your name. Maybe we could rent a boat, sail across the sunlit bay. You ramped up in your winter coat, just to keep the wind away. Spend the afternoon saying nothing. And when the sun goes down, light a fire and drink some wine. Slowly drive back into town. The pecs don't do it justice. You can see the things I see. Don't need to hear about a second hand. You'd be there if you did to come along with me. Oh, yeah. Rolling into a city at night. Every street has a name. Remind me of the places that I've been to. It all begins to look the same. But underneath the banners and the lights, my mind begins to change. The humming that I'm feeling at the center of town keeps calling out your name. I wish that you could tag along. Sit beside me at a restaurant. Drinking whiskey to 3 in the morning, singing harmony on that karaoke song. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going on and on and on. Let's don't do it justice. If you could see the things I see, don't need to hear about a second in. To come along with me. The bags that don't do it justice. You can see the things I see. Don't need to hear about it secondhand. You'll be there if you dare to come along with me.
All right, well, in the studio live with the Small Glories, Carol F., J.D. Edwards, thanks for coming in. Thanks for playing some tunes.
We're very honored to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So about to release Assiniboine in the Red, kind of release it and then release it. weird situation where you're doing a Winnipeg show basically a month before the album officially comes out. I'm always curious to talk to artists about kind of like playing a show for an album that fans haven't necessarily heard yet. And what your approach is when that material is foreign to people?
It's a good question. I don't know if it's is it completely foreign?
I mean, you've obviously released some singles up at this point, mm-hmm. but like,
if
I think
you,
only a few people have heard the full record.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, some of the songs. There's a couple of the songs that are on that record that have been re-recorded. With the new spirits behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So those songs aren't particularly foreign.
I
don't know. To the people who have listened to us for a while, you know, have been following us for the last few years, I think songs like Oh My Love is a song that people mm-hmm. have definitely heard before. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's just,
we've also been throwing a lot of the new songs into our live set just so that we're comfortable playing them,
right,
and people have been hearing them live. I guess we're... tell me how you feel about this, J.D. I think that we rarely play Winnipeg, and so because we're out on the road so mm-hmm. much. And so we see this show as kind of this real special opportunity to celebrate with the audience, and it's kind of the only time that we can do it. until the fall. And so we're like, no, let's get her done. Let's celebrate with our home community. And everybody's been behind us so much since we started, essentially. Some of those people have heard these songs and little things that we've done in the area. And as we've been touring, various people from Winnipeg have showed up at gigs. So I don't know if it's necessarily a bad thing.
Mind you, no one's heard the record.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the singles that we've released. So, there's that element, you know.
Yeah.
Sure, perhaps someone has heard a song or two live,
but the
record is a really special thing and a unique thing. I think people will enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think the label is actually seeing this as a really cool way to build up a little bit of buzz before the album is officially released. They're like, wow, if your hometown, if those are the only people who are going to be able to hear that record before it's released to the rest of the world. And so people are going to start talking about it online. They're going to tell their friends about it so that when it actually comes out, there's a little bit of momentum behind it already.
Some Instagram videos from the West End next
week.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
We hope so.
Yeah, we encourage anyone who's coming to our show, bring your cameras and take that stuff. I think that is great. We have no problem with that.
Yeah, it's super, super cool.
So, I mean, both of you come from other projects, other like solo pursuits or group endeavors, and have experience as songwriters. And I'm curious about coming together, if there's a change in dynamic, like do you have to kind of shift who you are as a songwriter to work as the Small Glories, or did you find kind of like just a natural balance between the two of you? You know, is it something that took work, or was it just kind of a easy fit?
I think as songwriters, I think we really respect what the other person is doing regardless of the projects that we've been in. So, I don't know. I think that we maybe approach, like if we're working on songs, we might say, oh, this one would be a really good Small Glory song and kind of veer towards that. JD, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that everything is going to take work. I think we were very surprised and relieved that when we started singing together, it seemed to be very natural. We really harmonized well with one another. I think we have a lot of some similar influences, and we have this course that we're on. I think that we share a lot of similar projections and goals. But I mean, you know, and as songwriters, I had to work it a lot differently with the songs that I've written, because most of the time my experience is although I have sung with other people in the past and harmonized, but the majority of my songwriting has sort of been like I sort of take a lead and then this band or my music sort of
follows
that. Yeah. But with the Small Glories, we kind of agreed that we didn't want to necessarily be just two artists backing each other up. We wanted to really fuse our sound and our music and our songs together. So there's a few songs that we've done in the past, like No Friend of Mine and Had I Paid, for example. Yeah. Those are two songs that we've brought from our other projects or our other solo endeavors, and we have morphed them and molded them and nurtured them to be Small Glories tunes, and so there is a total difference. So it took a little bit of work to do that, which is okay to say.
Yeah.
But it was enjoyable work, and it was something that we were, you know,
pleasantly surprised.
It was easy,
I think.
You know. Yeah. It was we weren't sitting down on these hard chairs. We were sitting down on nice comfy chairs, and we were adjusting ourselves. And then now it is what it is. You know, I don't know. It's a little bit of both. We've really tried to find a balance between this.
Is it a move from like having like your own individual voice as a songwriter to finding kind of a collective voice that is the Small Glories, like that you're not JD, you're not Kara, you're the pair?
Yeah, I guess we've kind of from the get-go, we've, like as JD was saying, we've really tried to be not in a support role of each other. We're supporting each other, but we are going out as a unified front. We are the Small Glories.
You're not trading songs.
Well, like I said before, I think we really try to fuse our songs and fuse our sounds. Yes, there's two of us. Yes, we've had two different careers. We come from different places. But our goal was to try to to use that stuff and fuse it together mm-hmm. to do this new project as the Small Glories. I mean, it's been 5 years, but you know, to a lot of people, it's still new. But that's our goal, is to step up together, is to sing together. So when you listen to the songs, for instance, a lot of the songs are us singing together throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think
we
wanted that.
Yeah, we wanted that.
We're trying to take two voices and make one.
Yeah. And there's also this cool thing that I think we've both stumbled upon, and we're really happy that we stumbled upon it, in terms of we're both very strong lead singers and we're both very strong harmony singers, but we're not stuck in those roles. So even within a song, you'll hear JD sing a melody line and then he swaps to a harmony, and I'll start with the harmony and then swap to the melody. And so when people are hearing the song, they actually, sometimes the melody isn't even sung. It's implied we're both singing a harmony line. And so we've really, I think it's been really interesting to kind of, we kind of joke around and be like, well, let's do our Small Glory signature thing where we're going to swap parts halfway through a line or halfway through a verse or something like that. And so that's been a very, I don't know, that's something that I've never quite experienced before. And I find it quite interesting. And
there's like a fluidity to the dynamic.
Yeah. And because we've been singing together consistently for a long time now, when we do bring new material to the group, it doesn't take us as long to sort out. We just kind of naturally, it's not that it comes to us immediately. We still have to work at it. But I think that we know how to work it now. And I think initially when we were starting to sing together, it was there was this shift of like, okay, wait, we're not just in our own little zones. We have to work at this together. So
right. Now, JD, you were mentioning off air, your oldest is just under five. And you said you guys have been Small Glories for about 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And women often get asked about their roles as like mothers and musicians. And I always make a habit, if there's a dad, mm-hmm. to talk to him about what impact mm-hmm. that's had. And it's been in tandem, obviously, mm-hmm. with the Small Glories.
Yeah, I have a great photo of my wife super pregnant when we were recording.
Oh, that's
the,
right.
The record, because I brought her out there. What's the question?
So I'm curious about sort of like the impact of parenthood on like,
yeah,
either your like creative role or you know.
Well, you know, to be completely honest with you, it's been quite difficult to be very creative at home, not like when I used to be. Now it's nice because now my son goes to school and my other son goes to daycare, so at least I have some hours to be creative at home. But it's difficult. I mean, there's just a huge part of me now that is always thinking of my family, and I, you know, and wanting to support them and raise them and to give them as much love and attention as I possibly can. But you know, I still have to be very diligent with my music and have give as much respect to Kara and the project as possible. So, you know, it's really about just finding that balance. And if anything, my kids having children now has been a huge influence into for me to work harder, to go further, to really be over serious about this, because what am I gonna do? Like, you know, I guess I could quit and do something else. But I think this is a great opportunity to teach my children that if you find something that you love and you work for it and you put everything that you possibly can into it, and in hopes that, you know, that the lesson that they see is that they want to do that too. I hope they don't become musicians. I mean, I hope that they're into music. I don't want to ever, like,
I mean, stop them from doing it. Like,
yeah, I don't want to stop them from doing it, but I'd be like, I don't know, maybe you should, like, you know, be a doctor, or, like, be a scientist. Like, be a scientist, man, you know, and play music on the side.
I think one of the things that we've really talked a lot about in the group is making sure that we each have home time.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly for JD, it's critical that he's home with his family. And so if we're out on tour, we'll look at the tour and be like, okay, is this a wise decision? Do we really want to be gone for 3 weeks? What's the absolute latest that we can, or the longest that we can go for?
Yeah.
And if there are pockets of time, we've really lucked out and been able to fly JD home for 3 days or something, and then he'll fly back out and meet me. There was one exception. We did an Australia tour, and it was 6.5 weeks, and that was...
Well, when you go that far,
you kind of got to, and
there's, you know, Kara's right, all those things you said, and then, but there's also variables, you know, it's all, like in this game, if the tour is going to be profitable, then we might, you know, lean towards, well, I might stay out an extra week or whatever, you know, but those things, I think there's all these variables.
It's your
but
job.
It is important to stay connected with family, because if things are going sour with the family, I don't see how it can go nicely with the rest of life. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm just always curious about
it's finding the balance. You know?
Yeah. So the record's called The Cinnamon Boy in the Red. Obviously,
where do you think we got that from?
Yeah, exactly. you know, I mean, this album is about to come out in the States on Compass, like Red House Records subsidiary there. They might not know what you're referring to, but obviously this Winnipeg audience that's listening, they understand it. How central is place to your songwriting? And
JD, why don't you take that one?
We feel, Kara and I are both from away. She's from Alberta, I'm from Ontario. And we met here in Winnipeg. I'd like to think that the rivers kind of have there's a representation of us and the rivers. The rivers meet here. The rivers are from away, but they meet here in this city. And so I kind of groove on that a little bit. How Kara and I were from away and we've met here. So I think a lot of these songs when they were written, we had this theme of where you're from. Stories
place,
of our place, of our land. The record is not necessarily just about Winnipeg. There is some definitely references to Winnipeg, mainly a song called Winnipeg. But it's also about Alberta. It's also about the road and other places that we've been to in this beautiful country. I think it's awesome how a lot of these songs are written on the East Coast, but they all have this Western pull to them. If that makes sense, and your listeners, I think, will pick up on that once they finally hear the record. But
and this sense of place, it's so critical to us, I think, because we're on the road so much. So we're always thinking about home. We're hearing stories about other people's homes. There's a song that JD and Lynn Miles wrote about Johnson's Landing, this really beautiful community that was affected by this tragic landslide. And so we are hearing these stories, and we're taking those stories around the world, and we're telling people in Australia about a small little town in the Kootenays of British Columbia. We're telling people about Winnipeg. We're telling people about all sorts of things. And the other day, JD and I were doing an interview, and JD, you said something really, really great about how even though the songs have a sense of place, there is also a lot of there are songs that really don't have any boundaries at all. There's no borders. They're very universal. And people can relate to them. So, but there really is that rooted theme, I think, of where we're from and part of what we love doing is talking about where we're from. And that's just part of being a Canadian touring artist. You have to go away to kind of eke out a living. So,
well, speaking of going away, after next Friday when you do the West End release, what's kind of the immediate term plans?
We go up to the Yukon. We're playing a bluegrass festival up there, and it's actually quite, as a little side thing, we get hired at quite a few bluegrass festivals, which is hilarious because we're not bluegrass. But
they see the banjo.
They see the banjo, and I think we're like a palate cleanser. If you're hearing hardcore,
the small glory sorbet.
Yeah, like you hear hardcore bluegrass nonstop, your ears need a little bit of something slightly different. So I small glory sorbet. Then we're doing a radio tour down in the Northeast. We start in D.C., we do New York, Boston, and a whole bunch of areas up in there. And then I think July 5th, we kind of hit the ground running. We've got a week of shows back in the Northeast of the States. We fly to the West Coast. We do something in Oregon, L.A., Santa Barbara. And then we fly to, I think we're in Ontario for a couple festivals. We're in the East Coast for a bunch of festivals. Back to Ontario.
Colorado,
Edmonton, Grand Prairie, Wisconsin, Michigan. And then I think a September long weekend our last festival, official festival date is in Seattle or around Seattle, so August 30th. So it's kind of, I was actually looking at her schedule the other day going, okay. I mean, it's great, but...
A little brace yourself.
Yeah, a little bit of bracing. And we're looking at bringing a tour manager driver with us for a lot of that, mainly because we find, we joke and say we're professional drivers because that's what we do so much on the road. And it'd be just really nice to give ourselves a little bit of, I don't know, a chance to just actually relax in the car and not have to be navigating all the time. So
sure enough. Well, the album gets its Winnipeg release next Friday at the Western Cultural Center, and then end of June, the actual Listen, Born in the Red. So we're going to give people a taste of the record, and you guys pick the track Winnipeg. I'm guessing it's for the obvious reasons.
What would give you that idea, Michael?
I don't know. Maybe I'm being obtuse. So we'll give that one a listen. Thanks very much for coming in and playing and chatting, guys.
Thanks
really appreciate it.
We really appreciate it.
Spread the word.
In the heart of the continent, ancient rhythm flows through the land. Carve the trails and let me hear all the songs that called us out. Old traditions and word of mouth, heard it calling from the east to the west. Took my roots on the old highway, traveled for about 2 or 3 days. Wrote a song with a new sound. Look at me now, I'm Winnipeg bound. It's the socials at the hall, watching bombers playing ball. It's the Sunday night cruise down on Portage Avenue. It's the northern lights, it's the snowplows at night. It's your parka and your toque, it's the way you wear your boots. And it's the sun. To the west, it's Métis, English, and French, and it's the sun.
The sun ain't keeping your love here, so keep on calling my phone, leave it home.
It's the sun.
The sun ain't into the sun here, to let water run in his arms and get back. Une table qui nourrit. On voit les
Mr. Young and the guess who? It's mosquitoes and canoes. It's the harvest in the field. It's another record year. It's the jet sweet and gold. It's always 35 below. It's the music and the vibe where our spirit comes alive. It's the sun on the prairies lifting up my soul. Called us out, old traditions and word of mouth.